Welcome to Conversations. I'm Bill Kristol. I'm joined here on September 30th, the end of the month, by my friend Mike Murphy, a longtime Republican political consultant, strategist, media genius, etc., self-proclaimed, and occasionally by others.
Hardly.
And associate right now, as it happens, in our Republican Voters Against Trump effort. But we're gonna be analytical here and not tell anyone what to do. We had a conversation a month ago, almost exactly, September 1st it was, and you said, and I remember this, it was striking to me, that if these races are to change, they more often change in September than October. Everyone focuses on October, but September is the month where you really get to introduce a new theme or idea that can take off, new ads that can work, new developments. We began the month, I believe, Biden was up about 7 points in the averages. We ended the month, and we'll talk about the debate that happened last night in a few minutes, but we ended before the debate, Biden was up 7 points in the averages. So, but it's not as if nothing happened, right? Supreme Court vacancy, all kinds of this Woodward book, the Atlantic article on Trump on veterans. So all this stuff happens and the race didn't change at all. Or maybe it did beneath the surface. Anyway, tell us what happened this last month.
Well, what I would say is, looking at it from a campaign point of view, September is the month where you try to introduce new issues, particularly coming out of the conventions into the second half of September. So you frame what you're going to litigate in the first couple of weeks of October, but then early voting kicks in and, you know, it becomes more about harvesting the vote you've hopefully persuaded. So what has happened, you're right, is the race has been pretty static because, let me put it this way, in an alternate universe, the Trump folks would have had a competent convention. Biden had a competent convention, and they would have done some good for Trump with the convention, knowing he's in the hole, particularly with women. And then they would have started an offense on Biden that had some traction, that was disciplined. Kamala Harris is going to be his partner, most liberal senator. Can't trust Biden on the economy. You know Trump is better on the economy. There were themes available. And if they'd focused and pounded away, they might have made some traction in a scenario where they were, you know, they had a coherent strategy. And then the big exclamation point would have been the 29th debate, which is they would have built up, they would have had a good debate, and then they would have framed October to try to close the race. They probably would have closed it a little if they'd done all those things. Instead, well, you're absolutely right, Bill. There have been an avalanche of things happening. I mean, I think we're scheduled for a locust plague in 2 days. You know, it's just cats are chasing dogs right outside, alien invasion on the 5th. You know, things keep happening, but in the campaign narrative, not a lot happens. And I think that the secondary development in all this is during September, the Biden campaign was able to dramatically outmuscle the Trump campaign on paid media, digital and particularly television in those six key states, because the Trump campaign had blown up $800 million on ridiculous overhead, you know, idiot relative legal bills, fundraising, prospecting, trying to find new donors on Facebook. And I don't want to beat up on Brad Parscale at a time when he's having a lot of trouble in his life. Maybe deserved some of it, but there was massive incompetence and they burned their cash. So Biden was beating him 2-3. In some states, Trump wasn't on the air, which is a huge requirement to have a good September to break things through. So it was kind of a fail on every side. So it came down to and we're going to talk about this, the president's ability to use the debate platform to reclock. And well, we know from the smoldering ruins of the debate stage how that went. So they, whatever opportunity September generically brings, Trump was unable to execute like that. And the Biden people, with their resource advantage and kind of deftly fending off the looter and disorder thing with both $40 million in paid spending and Biden, although a day or two late, coming up with a plausible defense, the Trump campaign was denied September, which is a huge thing when you're behind in a presidential campaign to lose. You frankly can't afford to do that.
Yeah, I think you said on September 1st that, you know, one of Biden's vulnerabilities probably was the looting and rioting, and that Biden had been somewhat adept at saying, no, I'm against violence. But still, it remained it's certainly been a go-to thing for Republicans for a long, long time. And there was enough there on the left wing of the Democratic Party and Democratic mayors and things that could have been exploited. But do you think they didn't really try to consistently, or just it doesn't work anymore in America in 2020?
Part of it is it doesn't have the old traction. You know, keep in mind that America under 18, the next big cohort, is, you know, almost majority minority. You know, it's about a 55-45 split. So America under 40 is a lot more multicultural than 70-year-old politicians remember. So when they go into the suburbs, which are also a lot more, you know, Orange County of now is not the Orange County of before. The Democrats carry it. It's still middle class. It's still an opportunity for Republicans there. But it's not the Lily White, Ozzie and Harriet thing that's probably in Trump's head and Mitch McConnell's head and others who figure that'll always work in the suburbs. So the suburbs are different. The racial weapon that guys like Trump tried to use doesn't have the power it once did. And again, the Biden guys made a big call. They said, look, we don't want to be debating looting. I'm sure the woke department of the Biden campaign, which is overstaffed, was full of complaints about how it's, you know, going to irritate supporters and everything. But the Biden guys knew this isn't going away, so we got to engage. So let's spend $40 million, a big bullet of television, and a couple of speeches and focus to grab this thing for 2 weeks and try to beat it to a draw. And in the polling, they'd even done a little better than that. So I think it was a combination of those issues. And again, if Trump were, and I'm kind of glad he isn't, because his weakness here helps him lose. But if Trump were better and could operate more subtly about the worries that the middle class has about violence and disorder in the streets, instead of bleeding a bullhorn all the time, it would have been more effective. What happened instead, and I think the Biden folks messaged this well, was that Trump became perceived as the arsonist fireman. Hell, he's causing all this disorder and he's making it worse. Get rid of Trump, you get rid of the disorder. And so it never got the traction the Trump campaign wanted. I mean, it did a little damage here and there. We see it in some of the voter data I'm looking at, but it has been pretty much spitballs against a battleship compared to the big hammer that I'm sure the kind of backward-thinking Trump leadership thought it would be.
Before we get to last night's debate, just a couple more points that you've indirectly raised I think are interesting for people interested in campaigns and politics. I mean, you mentioned TV a couple of times, both the Biden advantage, just because they raised so much money on being on the air, and then the $40 million particularly they spent to try to sort of neutralize the looting issue. I mean, I take it you don't quite buy the sort of modern, TV doesn't matter anymore. Everyone's, you know, no one's watching advertisements. Everyone's fast-forwarding through them or taping the shows, or everyone's watching Netflix anyway, and so you don't have ads on. I mean, what about that sort of argument? Is there some truth to it? I mean, you still seem to put a lot of weight on having tens of millions of dollars to hammer home a message on TV.
I would say the old slogan that's been around 100 years is true. It pays to advertise. And just the difference is now it's much more of a 360 approach where you want to get them on television. You want to serve them ads on streaming. I mean, we can literally insert ads now in people off voter lists on DirecTV to only play to that set box. You want to get them on their smartphone, which is a huge information channel. You know, there's still a world for both digital streaming radio like Spotify or even terrestrial radio in cars. So, you know, the audience is a little more elusive because they have so many more channels. But you still want to surround them. And there's still a reason why you can go up and say Simon Cowell and people will give you an opinion. It's not because he's on TikTok. So what you got to do is have a holistic view to kind of find the audience you want and then surround them with all their media habits. And, you know, that's what smart campaigns do. There's much more digital spend now. But there was a phase where a bunch of smart kids with complicated eyewear would show up and talk gobbledygook about digital. I always enjoyed this because I built my first computer myself with a soldering iron. But the older campaign people are normally intimidated and don't want to look stupid, so they nod a lot. Data analytics, yeah, that's the key. And, you know, Hillary went down that route, and I think there are some kids in complicated eyewear trying to explain what the hell happened on election night. So I think we're a little bit back to the fundamentals now with the total respect for digital and other places. You figure out who your eyeballs are, and then you go where they are. And in almost every case, there is some role for either cable or broadcast television. It doesn't have to be the largest share. For some audiences, it is. Seniors are a big part of the war in Florida. Broadcasting cable has a huge impact there. But, you know, with other audiences, there are other things. So the truth is, it's never the one man, you know, pot holders with the campaign logo on them. Those were a huge idea in 1976. We mail them to every voter. It's a heavy envelope. They're going to open it, and every day they're going to use that pot holder and think of Mulligan for, you know, believe me, there's always a thing. And it's generally just good communication and good advertising, all driven by the quality of your message. You know, we spend a lot of time optimizing, we're 7% more effective with underwater TikTok. Yeah, but if the message is crap, it doesn't matter. And Trump has a crappy message.
Yeah, and one last thing on the message. I think you did think on September 1st when we spoke, and this was not, I mean, unique. This was a pretty common view based on the polls, that Trump had a bit of an opportunity on the economy. He was consistently even or slightly ahead of Biden on economic management, whatever the downside of his management of the pandemic and ignoring public health experts. He had sort of identified himself as the guy who really cared about getting the economy going again, so it wasn't implausible for him to try to ride that horse. But that didn't seem to happen much in September, or what?
Well, Biden is now running, and he has for about 10 days, he's been running pretty heavy advertising, kind of going after that number through the prism of motive. You know, who's on your side? It's billionaires versus a guy from Scranton. And I think the tax return may help that. And then also the Supreme Court debate has focused through, you're going to lose your pre-existing conditions, which was a very effective message for the D's in 2018. So, but you're right. I mean, in the polling, when you ask people who's better, it's still Trump. And so the problem is Biden could be winning a state by 5 points, but he's losing who's better on the economy to Trump by 6 points. So if Trump can make the whole campaign about the economy, and that becomes the most important thing voters are voting on, the race is going to close. And I think the Biden people are chipping away at him and at that, but they've been benefiting from Trump's inability to be focused enough to move the race to the economy. And also COVID is hard to move, because it's a huge deal and it's in people's lives. So Biden's profited from all that. Though, if I had one note to the Biden campaign, I would attaboy their move into the economic motive space, and I tell them to double it.
Is that right?
Two things that really work for Biden are Biden can bring the country together into one team. That is very effective with Democrats, and it's extremely effective with independents. And it works with soft Republicans. We're at RVAT, we're running advertising about that with millions of dollars in Florida. The other thing that works, you know, for Biden is the idea that he's better at handling COVID. The only thing that works for Trump is the economy. So the more Biden can chip away there, you cut the one filament that Trump's spider is hanging from, and they could do more.
You think the populist sort of message on the economy works a little bit? You know, Trump's for the billionaires, I'm for the regular guy kind of thing. That you seem to, when Biden looked at the camera to get to the debate last night, that seemed to be one of the things he really had wanted to say directly to the American people.
Yeah, I don't think, like, Trump has tried all this pharma bashing, and there are votes there, but they've never packaged it into the campaign. The problem is every time the Trump guys have something they could sell some tickets on, Trump gets in the way because he gets mad at somebody on cable TV, or he cheats on his taxes for 10 years and it gets on the front page of the, you know, there's always some Trump-driven train wreck that gets in the way of a Trump campaign doing things in Trump's interest. And Trump is essentially at war with his own campaign. One, I don't think it's a technically good campaign because he's down to the dregs of the Republican Party for the most part. But even you know, they get a few of the basics right, and Trump just cannot avoid disrupting his own machinery through his antics, and they have no way to control him. You know, ultimately, Trump's campaign is Trump, and Trump's a bit of a madman. So, you know, the idea of a disciplined prosecution of the case that you can't trust Biden and Harris on the economy, Trump will manage the recovery right, Trump has empathy on COVID and Operation Warp Speed is, you know, things are getting better. All that stuff that a normal campaign would do, Trump would rather blow up the news cycle every day with his whims, and that really, you know, kind of puts an insurmountable obstacle in front of him.
So the debate last night, speaking of, it was bad for the, we'll stipulate that it was kind of a horrible moment for America.
How many showers did you take? I did 4 and I still felt awful.
I felt really sort of physically ill, I got to say, almost at points of it. President of the United States, I mean, maybe you and I have been too close and admired some of these politicians we've worked for, Romney and McCain and George H.W. Bush and stuff. But I mean, to see that as the actual debate between the two presidential candidates was it was below a level where we once wouldn't have tolerated this in a congressional debate.
I know. I mean, you and I have both been in the quiet room that people don't see, where we've seen them at their worst, but most of the time we've seen them at their best. Even you know, members of Congress or senators, if you staff politicians, you see things to admire of, and you see imperfect people, but you see that. And so we kind of, and my Democratic friends say the same thing in the kind of the political operative world and the policy staff world. You know, this is our church, and Trump is just desecrating the damn thing. Nobody gets into a political life because they hate politics. They can be depressed at the cynicism, but fundamentally they're believers at heart. And Trump is just you know, he's anthrax to that. He's just every he, there is absolutely he operates completely in bad faith in all things at all times. And that's just exhausting. And to see it in that debate, this insecure man child screaming and yelling like a toddler. I mean, while we're trying to, you know, be a superpower, we're trying to be the metronome beat of the free world. And by the way, we're trying to remain the reserve currency. It was just a bad night for America.
So let's talk about I agree with that. Let's talk about the politics of it, though. I mean, what was there?
That was my sermon. I'm
that was good. That was very good. We'll have to have a little bit of that before we get back to. So what do you think? I mean, was it just Trump being Trump, Biden being Biden, no big deal? Did it make a difference? And you've probably even seen, 24 hours later now, you've seen a little bit of focus groups and, you know, polling data.
Yeah,
and
I haven't seen groups yet. I'd give the polling a little while to cook because you measured the debate audience, which it appears the early numbers look low.
Yeah,
you know, which is a sign that people have had it. They just want to vote and end the nightmare. And my guess is that trend will accelerate. In fact, I think the Biden folks ought to kind of send that message. If you're tired of this crap, just vote. You know, then you're off the hook. You've done your thing. And it's good for them to lock in early vote. My view is, again, this should have been the crescendo of a good September to give Trump something to work with in October and change the terms of the debate. He didn't get that September, and he sure didn't get that debate. So it was a win for Biden. I mean, I thought Biden's performance was clunky. He looked old. He had a few good moments when he was defending his son. When he talked directly to the camera, he was doing better. And the good thing for Biden is they will cut those out, and that'll be part of the abbreviated media clips that a lot of people will see since the audience wasn't that large. But even Biden, being a wobbly in many ways, was blown away by the fact his opponent set himself on fire and, you know, pissed all over the set. So Trump managed to even take the spotlight away from whatever Biden's weaknesses are, which means, you know, he hurt himself more than he hurt Biden. He didn't reset the race, which he desperately needs to win. He repelled the suburban female voters that he desperately needs to catch up because he's losing. And, you know, he created another news story that Trump's an impossible child and an embarrassment that'll burn 5 more days of the campaign, which is, you know, almost 20% of the campaign days left. So he's burning a resource that he desperately needs, good campaign days, by you know, being the I'll use the vice president's phrase, the clown that he was. So it was a huge epic loss to Trump that's almost not connected to how Biden did. You know, there's some Democratic bedwetting, oh, why didn't Joe do this, why didn't Joe do that? But by just showing some sobriety and acting like a president and having a few good lines the media can use and connecting through the camera and showing empathy, which Trump clearly doesn't have. I mean, it's unheard of for an American president not only to essentially give a wink and a smile to white supremacists, but not to even say anything about Biden's son, his decorated veteran. Trump blew opportunities, and I think net-net hurt himself, not only in opportunity cost lost, I think he hurt himself just in chipping away at people who have Trump fatigue and say, I can't take it anymore. I got to vote for a change, even if ideologically I'm not center-left.
You know, I watched some of the clips this morning, and I thought last night Biden did okay, but a little shaky and missed some opportunities. But I've got to say this morning I was a little more impressed in the sense that, I mean, it isn't that, whatever, Trump's, you know, it's terrible and a lot of blowing himself up. But you can also blow up the person next to you if you're blowing yourself up. And there were moments where I thought, what would I have done if Trump had said this, was interrupting constantly? And Biden he kept his cool.
Yeah.
He you know, got into it a little with Trump, enough to look like he wasn't being bullied, I think. But then he would sort of pivot and speak to the camera and in a pretty effective way. I think he did a little better, I guess I now think, than I thought, you know, less than 24 hours ago, for whatever that's worth.
And I'll tell you, the best bites look a lot better than the whole debate for Biden, which is great, because that's what a huge amount of people will see. And I think you're totally right. Talking to the camera was some of his best stuff. If I were him in the third debate, because the next one's the town hall, you know, all those poor people. But for the next one, I'd do the whole thing to the camera. I'd basically say, look, there's an orangutan over here who's going to shout and interrupt. Just tell me if he sets himself on fire, we're trying to put him out. But otherwise, I'm going to talk to you about what you're going to get if I'm president, because you need help. And just totally talk at home and ignore him as a buffoon.
Anything? Well, let's get to so let's talk about the next debates, and we can come back and talk about this one a little bit, too. I guess the white supremacist thing is the one substantive thing that seems to have lasted through a news cycle or two, and Trump sort of addressed it this afternoon, but that means it does last through tomorrow, at least.
Right, but he still wouldn't, you know, in American president or credible candidate school like Lesson One is. Now, if you're asked your position on white supremacists, Nazis, that kind of thing, you go immediately to, I'm against it. And Trump still can't go there.
Right.
Because he feels loyalty to, quote, his people, even if they're wearing hoods and swastikas, which is unbelievable. And again, Trump will be tangled up for another few days on this, deservedly so.
Yeah.
And again, as the clock ticks.
Yeah, and I guess one thing I'll say, I talked to a fair number of people, as you did, I'm sure, in between various other Zoom calls and so forth this morning and today. I think especially among a couple of women I spoke with who were, you know, pro-life, care a lot about the Supreme Court, were kind of, don't like Trump, but I could tell they didn't quite want to tell me this, but they were kind of edging back towards maybe either voting for Trump or certainly not voting for Biden, because they have genuine problems with Biden and so forth. I do think the personal demonstration of his character and the thought that four more years of this, people just, it kind of held, you know, it cut off a possible sort of reversion to Trump among at least a couple of percent, I've got to think, of those independents and soft Republicans.
Well, it's definitely a headwind because it was a real transparent look at who Trump is. And it just becomes harder to justify, because I think one thing the debate did do, at least for the thinking audience, because look, I'm sure in Trump world, you know, half of his core support, the loonier half or the more loutish half, are excited. They like the combat. They like Trump being a cartoon character. You can probably go buy a MAGA hat with Viking horns on it today. You know, so in that world, that subset, it was probably a home run for Trump. But the problem is it doesn't matter. He's got all those votes, and it's not enough to win. But I would think among others, you know, all the justifications and everything, this debate refocused everybody that the choice is not just right and left. The choice is whether or not we want normalcy in our democracy or hostility to it, contempt for the institution. So you're going to vote for that? Really? And, you know, I think I'm with you. I think that'll chip a little off him. Not a lot, but a little.
So what next? I mean, so October begins tomorrow, and we got the vice presidential debate, two presidential debates, if they happen, which I guess
people... If anybody watches, but yeah.
And yeah, I mean, other things could happen, God knows, as we've seen in the... I mean, it's funny you mentioned the tax returns just a few minutes ago. I'd sort of forgotten that happened, what, 4 days... I mean, what, 3 days
ago? That's the thing about Trump.
I mean, I can't even remember that, you know? Yeah. That was a...
There's an earth-shaking thing every third day, and it's just doubled down by the next earth-shaking thing. I mean, imagine if we were doing this 10 years ago, and an American presidential candidate in a fall debate called somebody a clown.
Yeah.
That would be huge news. Remember, our old boss... Herbert Walker Bush looked at his watch once at a photo op, and that lit things up for 3 hours, or during a debate, too.
Yeah.
So now we're to the world where it's all been so devalued that there's new antics. But it has a cumulative effect, I think. So the question in the debate world will be, one, will anybody watch the next debates, or are people just tuning off and voting early? Two, in a town hall debate, will Trump behave, or will he start yelling at an audience member? My guess is he'll try to behave, but I don't think psychologically. And, you know, I love that his debate coach on nuance is Chris Christie. You know, so it's just, this thing becomes a self-parody more and more every day. Steve Scully, who's a widely respected journalist, is going to be the moderator. I sent a telegram to the debate commission because I know they're kind of an antiquated organization, so I couldn't get a telex done. I did a telegram saying you ought to give him a fire hose, because if he doesn't have a mic kill switch or something to police Trump, there's no amount of admonition that, sir, excuse me, sir, you're violating Rule 11, sir. We know that if Chris Wallace can't pull that off, nobody's going to. So they've got to weaponize the moderator a little bit, and I think a mic kill switch is really the best way to do it, though I do think a live town hall format will slow Trump down a little bit. The problem will be the third debate when Trump is in real trouble and is panicking and, you know, is under all this business pressure we now know he's under, because he's the way he's bleeding cash, I think the whole billionaire thing is probably about a year away from vanishing. He's really going to be out of control then, and they're literally going to need foghorns and mic kill switches and a net to hold him down there. That's going to be another fiasco even beyond, I think, last night.
But I guess Biden... I mean, I suggest in the piece that, you know, Biden could honestly say this is terrible for the country, and I don't want to appear on a stage with this guy. I'll do town halls every other day. I'm going to expose myself to the American public. I'm not going to hide, but I don't want to deal with this guy. But I guess he has to go through the debate.
He has to go. Otherwise, he gives Trump the running away. Now, if I were the Biden guys, I would not at the Biden level. Biden should be talking about losing your pre-existing conditions and getting you back at work. But and it's interesting they're in Ohio, which is another state I think they can break Trump's back in. But I think the Biden campaign ought to start a big surrogate fight about a Mike Kill switch and let the Trump people fight. It just sets it up nicely that, you know, the debate of the campaign is the president enough of an adult to be able to talk without throwing tantrums every 5 minutes? It's a great way to kind of let the stench of this thing linger and stick it to Trump for a while.
Yeah, that's good, actually. So we'll see if they do that. So what, vice presidential debate? No, unlikely to change much.
I don't know if anybody will watch it again, which appears to be the trend, but I would say this. Pence had debated Biden last night, I think Pence would have won on performance because Pence is very smooth. And Kamala Harris, who's kind of very au courant, I don't think it's that good. You know, her one golden minute was ripping Biden's face off, and I think Trump has poisoned the well for face rippers in debates for a while. So I think what we could see, one, you have a lot of media tears about, oh, why can't the presidential debates be like this? Because, you know, they're both regular politicians, and they will behave more normally. So it'll be the anti-debate in style, and that'll be embraced as a throwback to what ought to be, which is a laudable point of view. And then I think Pence may do pretty darn well. Now, the problem for Pence is then the media will be, why, they ought to let Pence do all the debating around here. Pence is great. And, you know, it's like being one of Stalin's marshals and being in the paper. Boy, what, he's the biggest military genius in the Soviet Union. You're dead 3 days later. You know, it's over for you. So Pence is probably thinking he has to stand on the table and, you know, swing from the lighting grid just to avoid good reviews. But I think it might be a stumble for Kamala Harris. I think we might have our little 2 days of media, oh my God, are they back? Pence debate performance. There'd be some of that if Pence overperforms the expectations that, you know, dumb right-wing hick. And she, the massively talented, you know, hope for the Democratic future, maybe underperforms a little like she did on a regular basis in her presidential campaign. That dynamic will be interesting, I think.
And I take it the Biden campaign is going to play the pre-existing conditions card and mismanagement of COVID, as unfortunately it looks like it's not getting better in a lot of states. And just bring the country together, I suppose. That's their message, you think?
I think their main message is time for a president, you know, not a clown show. I can unite the country. We can tackle this stuff together. Huge appetite for that. Trump fatigue, put it in the rearview mirror. And, you know, the biggest manifestation of that will be getting the economy going again and conquering COVID once and for all with sane people, not somebody who wants you to drink Clorox. I think those are the main thrust with kind of a side beat of I'm on your side in the economy, not the billionaires. And that's pretty good. And the nice thing if you're Biden is you got this menu of stuff to do. You're doing well in all the states you need and some states that should be easily Trump. So you're deep into Trump's backfield. And every day you get to pick up and say, all right, 31 days to go. I think we're going to make today about ACA. I think we're going to make tomorrow about whose side is Trump on, his billionaire cabinet or folks like us here in Parma, Ohio. Day 3, we'll go to the suburbs, do a little pro-choice Supreme Court. Day 4, back to ACA. So Biden's got this great menu to keep Trump back on his heels, let alone whatever Trump does that's crazy in the next 2 weeks. So it's a nightmare for the Trump guys who want to make this about Biden. Now, you know, they've got a little window. If they pound on Kamala as the world's most liberal person, if they pound on can't trust Biden on the economy, and then Pence caps that with a good debate, they might be able to get a little something going. But every day that goes by where not a lot happens or it's a messy tie, that's a win for Biden. Trump's running out of days. He can't create more days.
And you think he's running out of days? Is that accentuated by the amount of early voting and people making up their mind early? Yeah. So it's not like I'm not sure in the old days you could make up that much in October either. I mean, you could in 1980. That was a sort of unique set of circumstances. But that's so amazing, the Reagan-Carter race. The one debate was 8 days before the election. And of course,
right. That's an old era.
And Reagan did fine. Well, they were supposed to have earlier debates, but somehow they couldn't agree. And was John Anderson going to be in them? And then Reagan did well. And basically everyone wanted to throw out Carter. they heaved a sigh of relief that, okay, Reagan's not crazy. We can throw out Carter. And they did throw out Carter. And the race went from a couple of points to about 9, I think, in the last week.
Yeah, I mean, I can
I don't
tell
think
you.
That's happened, though, in modern times much, right? I mean.
Well, there's just not that flexible late vote. We're also more entrenched, you know, where right. In a primary, you can have a 20-point swing because everybody's the same, or mostly the same. In a general election, no more than 11% is ever really in play. And in this race, it's more like 6%, and that's probably a little optimistic. So, you know, in our VAT work and the independent expenditures, our voter, our television, our digital, all the stuff we're doing to persuade people, we'll be done by probably the 21st of October. That's kind of, in our view, Election Day is 2 weeks long.
Yeah.
And so we want to peak by then, you know, in that first, really the second 10 days of October. That's kind of the new crescendo.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Then it's about turnout and banking your vote and, you know, getting vote early and going through election day in a coronavirus era where there are going to be mechanical issues.
Yeah, I want to ask you about, well, let's talk about that. Then I want to come back and talk about a couple of states and maybe what you've learned in trying to, in Florida, where you're running a pretty large campaign here to try to get independents and soft Republicans to go to Biden. But what about just the mechanics? I mean, do you think the parties are kind of basically, after all this storm and drang about this and that and Corona and vote by mail and this, at the end of the day, people are going to vote and the votes will get counted and the parties are kind of equally good at helping their voters vote? Or are you worried about some particular by some particular aspect of it?
I'm a big contrarian, and people in my cable TV life, when I'm opining about TV, often to somebody who's never run a campaign before, I often get raised eyebrows because the two cliches that you hear so much that drive me crazy are the base. Well, you know, the biggest mistake we make now in a lot of the political journalism is treating base voters like swing voters. Base voters will vote for a box of hammers if it has an R or a D on it. You know, they're not the vote that decide the election. It doesn't matter how happy you're easy to get voters are. You're going to get 90% of them. So the issue is more the persuadable voters. But every day on TV, always got to get out the base. It's all about when does the base all decide, you know what, we're not for Biden. The city of Oakland is now going to go for Donald Trump. No, it's insane. And they will say, well, there's turnout. Well, that's the second most overused word in a presidential race, in a general election. We know from like 100 years of this that the highest natural turnout races are presidential races. And you can do things at the margins. You know, Hillary in the city of Detroit's a good example of a failure there. But fundamentally, I would bet dollars to donuts that Hillary's failures were not that she didn't hire an extra 100 organizers, which there's always no shortage of people in local political organizations whose solution to every problem is hire my cousin, give him a cell phone and an expense account. The bigger problem was her message didn't work with voters who decided not to be for her, who normally would have been. So you have to optimize all that, and zillions of dollars will be spent. But the fundamental thing, you know, is less about base stuff, and it's more about who you can persuade. And then once they're persuaded and ID'd, you try to make it as easy as possible for them to turn out, which means you keep an eye on obstructions, like the trick that some pretty bad Republicans were trying in the last special election up in Wisconsin, and things like that. So it almost becomes a battle of logistics and lawyers at the end. And that's really what the turnout battle is all about. But you're in a situation in a presidential where people want to turn out. You know, the system, people who are habitual voters like to vote in presidential elections. So you got a huge tailwind. And the idea that some turnout program is going to make the ultimate difference, I think, is highly unlikely.
I mean, it feels like we could have very high turnout this year, even for a presidential year, probably the largest ever, because people on both sides are motivated. I guess one of the Trump arguments would be that they could turn out even more, you know, ex-urban and non-college whites, especially men, who will, you know, run up even bigger margins for Trump in central Pennsylvania and overwhelm the Philadelphia suburbs and stuff.
Yeah, state college to the rescue. The problem with that, I mean, yeah, so the Trump guys, and this is an old play, a lot of campaign, when you're losing, you get a lot of bad polls, you feel awful, and then people start coming up with the wonder weapons, you know, the long bomb is going to turn everything around. And one of the favorite ones is, hey, if we can't change the electorate we have, let's change the electorate. Well, in a special election, if you can convince Lithuanian presidential voters that because you're the only Lithuanian running for city council to vote in a special election, something most had never done before, You can do that, but it's extremely hard. It is rare and difficult. But in a presidential race where you already have high turnout, it's hard. So what the Trump people are saying is, look, there are a whole lot of white, non-college educated men in those places who are not registered to vote. So we're going to register them because they all love Trump. Well, the problem is, one, political scientists will tell you that people who choose not to vote, that's their choice. That's their thing. And they're sticky about it. You know, they just tend not to want to participate. And convincing them to participate is hard. Second, if you are a Trump-loving target unregistered voter like that, Bubba Crystal, living in rural Pennsylvania or northern Michigan, I think the argument that you have missed the whole Trump thing, you haven't had a chance to sign up, you missed it in 2016, but now you've been awakened to it and you want to vote, is a hard sell to me, because the Trump train has been loud and obvious for 4 years. And the idea you slept through that and you're suddenly interested is dubious. So they'll be able to drag a few in because they're going to throw what little money they have left at it. But for it to be a material difference, I think it's tough. I mean, the other problem, and I commend NBC News and the Cook Political Report and Dave Wasserman, who's a great guy to follow on Twitter, one of the analysts there, they did something I've been harping about for years. They did a demographic adjustment of the 2016 exit poll. So basically, they took the 2016 election. Now, I know when I say exit polls, people get nervous, oh, they're always wrong. Well, they're not always wrong. And after the election, they are reweighted to the real results so political scientists can look at what happened. Well, they took 16 and they adjusted it for demography based on who's died and what new young voters have registered to vote, because they've gone from being 14 to 18.
And also, and the relative size of each group, they've adjusted same. To the 2020 yeah. electorate while right, keeping right, the vote right. the same in that group, yeah. right?
That's sort they, of they adjusted the electorate, but they kept the vote share the same.
Right.
So if Trump got 18% of left-handed Irish guys with red hair, they left that the same. Just what's the percentage of those guys in the electorate? And, you know, Trump loses Michigan, loses, I believe, Pennsylvania. So Trump, in addition to all his self-created problems, is up against a demography that has made the electorate about a point more anti-Trump based on demography. So, you know, it's just...
That's just
it's
a diminishing share of yeah. white voters and diminishing share of non-college, I guess, both
right.
both of which
right.
are just facts of, as you say, demography and sociology, I guess, in the case
right,
of
right, right. No, the electorate's a dynamic thing. You don't want to fight demography. It's the hardest thing in the world to fight. The other thing about this ACA equals Supreme Court / ACA ruling equals you lose your pre-existing conditions. That is like a Star Wars lightsaber, as a lot of ex-congressmen will tell you from 2018 on the Republican side. But it has resonance with white, female, non-college, who are not as Trumpy as the men, but there's some Trumpy there. Because, you know, they're working class, so they got a union job, and they start worrying about their health insurance. So the Dems, Biden has a new weapon to go into that group and hurt Trump there. So, you know, yes, they can try to register new voters, but that is... That's going to be a very thin straw to try to pump enough voters through to change Trump's problems.
I mean, Biden, I thought, was actually not, surprisingly, not too good at making the core healthcare arguments, which are pretty simple if you're on that side of the debate in healthcare, to yeah. make last night. Even so, but they're putting up a lot of money behind those ads. And it's not untrue that the Trump administration is in court trying to have the whole ACA struck down. Now, the intelligent response to that is, fine, they want it struck down because the mandate isn't severable from the rest of it. And of course, Congress right. could repass a ban on pre-existing conditions and pass the rest of the ACA, frankly. The whole thing is a little bit overhyped, in my opinion, as an actual matter of public policy and the consequences of confirming or not confirming Judge Barrett and so forth. But yeah, it's a good talking point. And she has opined that it's when she was a law professor, that the whole thing's probably unconstitutional. And this is the funny thing. People are so much it's last time's war. So in 2018, the Supreme Court fight with Kavanaugh. 2016, keeping the Scalia seat open, I do think helped Trump, helped Republicans, helped mm-hmm. a certain type of mostly upper middle class, I would say, voter, as well as maybe some pro-life voters, to feel like it was so important to have keep the Scalia seat, so to speak. 2018, in red states, so not in Democrat, not in congressional swing districts, the Kavanaugh fight probably helped a little bit and reminded some voters in Missouri and places
right.
where
in states that are naturally Republican.
Yeah,
Republican
why they don't like those left-wing, the media yeah. and the Democrats.
Right.
And therefore, everyone assumed when Justice Ginsburg passed away that this was great for Democrats. But it was sort of obvious when you thought about it for 2 seconds that great for Republicans. Republicans. Yeah. But and they nominated an attractive candidate, an impressive woman and stuff. But at the end of the day, if we're going to have a debate on pre-existing conditions, and if they define the ACA, Obamacare, right, the Democrats, as pre-existing conditions, which they've done a pretty good job on, I would say, and Roe v. Wade, for that matter, for all that no one really wants to have a huge fight on abortion, because there's some pro-life people Biden needs to get. But Roe v. Wade is broadly popular, and I don't think a lot of people are out there hoping the whole thing gets thrown up in the air, and we have 50 states having bitter debates over whatever the merits, you know, of abortion policy. It just gave Biden a pretty easy talking point, which he used a little last night. I thought he didn't use as much as he could, which is, and they've done a pretty disciplined job of avoiding attacks on her, it seems to me, and personally, and sort of bracketing the whole question of whether she'll get confirmed, even, and just saying, this is their agenda, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it gives Biden kind of a Swiss Army knife. He's like, all right, Trump needs to get women, college-educated women in the suburbs back. How's the pro-life fight going to help with that? It's not. So, boom, I can kind of, the Vision 1 of the campaign, go crazy there. And meanwhile, in the money war, the small money war, pro-life now totally beats, pro-choice beats pro-life in fundraising. So now the Dems have a new $150 million for October in the Senate races. So in the suburbs, Trump's in a box, and this makes it worse, not better. Then he's got this ACA pre-existing condition ray gun. And even if Biden stumbles with it a little, the $100 million in advertising will not stumble. You know, it'll be tested and sharp and well done, and it's coming. Biden has about $250 million to spend in October on advertising to bomb the, I mean, the great thing, he just went into Ohio with $7 million. Trump's got about $1.80 in Ohio. I think Biden can take it from him. And Ohio, like Florida, is a state you can't win without, and they count absentees in real time. So if you win Ohio or Florida or both on election night, if you're Biden, you've broken Trump. I don't care about all the absentees in the other states and all that. Doesn't matter. The math is done. So the court fight gives Biden two good, you know, weapons, one that works almost everywhere, one that's great in the suburbs. Now, you can argue a good pro-life, pro-choice court fight could save Lindsey Graham in South Carolina, where he has, you know, got himself in trouble by being rubber man, you know, disappointing to me. He's an old friend, and I've been sad to see his Faustian decline. But the pro-life thing is good for him. You can argue it's a mixed bag, but in Iowa, it could be good for her. So there are a few Senate places where a pro-life fight can work. But net-net for Biden, this fight is good. And then finally, there's the good government vote. And anybody who saw the debate last night knows that they don't elect a president. But there's some of that, and they're just horrified at the idea at a time when our institutions are under complete attack, that the Republican Party, instead of kind of paying its penance for that, decides we're going to jam a Supreme Court case down in the waning hours of a failed presidency and a Senate majority that's in peril. So I think it's a winner for the Dems in almost all cases except a couple of Senate races.
Yeah, I think that's right. It was so funny that the conventional wisdom was so much the opposite for the first couple of days.
Well, it was back to the stuff I was whining about before. The base, this will excite
right.
The base.
Right.
The base is done. The base will vote for a block of cement. The base doesn't win the election. You know, back in the, I'm sorry, this is such a thing to me because I watch so much dumb coverage. But back in the 90s when Republicans were winning swing state governorships like crazy, and I was doing a lot of those races, we always put the base in some pain. I would rather have a grumpy base vote than a happy one. Because if I have a grumpy base vote, that's because I went out and got a lot of swing voters and I'm going to win the election. And I'll try to govern in a way that the base is not too disillusioned. When I'm doing kind of basturbation and making them really happy, I guarantee you I'm 5 to 7 points behind in a competitive state.
Yeah.
So it's silly. And it's the wrong compass to cover the election from. But, you know, most of these reporters don't know. They're more worried about, you know, not looking like idiots on TV and, you know, the colors don't clash. You know, no, it's just the nature of the TV world now.
And if you live or die by the Supreme Court and by the pro-life issue, which people are entitled to, I mean, then you're already for Trump, probably. I mean, the idea that they needed this particular moment to be remind them, the ones who aren't paying much attention now look up and say, geez, I didn't realize that pre-existing conditions are in trouble. I'm not on Obamacare, but I do want the pre-existing ban when I switch jobs next time, you know,
right.
the ban on not giving me insurance because of pre-existing conditions.
You know, so, just quickly, the other footnote for our pro-life single-issue voter friends, they have that right, but here's I hate to be the guy to shatter the dream, But one thing the Supreme Court hates to do, which kind of gets back to Roe v. Wade, which was, you know, most scholars agree, not particularly good constitutional law, but the court hates tearing the country apart. So if you think the court really is going to vote in the handmaiden law and blow everything up, it's naive. The court is political, and it doesn't make huge lurches like that. And there are justices on that court who are conservatives who I think will vote the first priority against massive turbulence. So the idea that you just you put in Barrett and it's done, and you know, abortion is going to be illegal in 50 states a year later is incredibly naive.
Yeah, well, first of all, 15 to 20 of those states would actually not make it illegal. So just right there, right. It's already
right,
unclear
right.
What the real world effect of it would be, except you would have debates in every state about what the law should be, which I'm not sure any real Republican, most real Republican politicians, even in Iowa, I was struck by this. Didn't Joni Ernst, I think, said something about, well, we're not going to be, I mean, that's probably not going to happen or something. She's a little nervous about actually debating
right.
Whether we're going to really ban all abortions, even in Iowa, yep. Which is supposedly a pro-life state. I mean, it's been very
it's
easy
slightly
for Republicans.
Pro-life. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very easy for Republicans to say they're pro-life. And
well, it's the only thing where you have the issue, but God forbid you don't want the vote.
Right. Yeah. Well, if you have to face reality on this, and that's a tough. I mean, again, whether for better or worse, but it is, I think, practically speaking, very, very tough. I agree with you about the court. Also, say, let's close by talk a little about what you're doing in Florida. Less about, I mean, you can talk about what you're doing for RVAP. You've done a ton of polling and focus groups and very targeted, trying to find out what messages work with these swing voters. What have you learned that's different from, you know, sort of the from looking at these voters?
Well, I think the one place that surprised me, David Hill, great pollster. I lost a bet with him last time. He said, you're not going to believe it. He was tracking an initiative. He said, I think Trump is going to carry Florida. And I was like, no, he's going to lose by 2 points. And, you know, I paid that bet. Hill was right. Only pollster I know who called it, including the Trump pollsters who all thought Trump was going to lose. So he's done 7 focus groups and a couple of polls for us focused on these kind of soft voters. And the thing that surprised me the most, one, we always assume they're a little more connected to this. They have a filter where this is more politics. The best message for him by far is unite the country, one team. Can't we get a politics that works, particularly the independents? There's Trump embarrassment and fatigue. But the place where the Democrats make a mistake is folks do not blame Trump for the COVID death toll. That is kind of a emotionally powerful issue that people in the Democratic bubble get rightfully upset about and therefore want to holler it. What they say is, look, this could have happened to anybody, these voters. You know, Trump didn't cause it. It came. Trump was the unlucky guy in the job. And yeah, he stumbled around for a while, but Obama would have stumbled. We'd never seen this before. Everybody, it's kind of like a hurricane to them. It just kind of happened. There was going to be destruction. And then the crazy ones get into, you know, they're faking the stats and all that. But for the most part, they're kind of like, you know, you can criticize how Trump has handled it, but blaming him for deaths and calling him a murderer, that's way over the top, is crazy. What would Joe Biden have done? He was there 47 years. Did he do anything about COVID? No. Did he get ready for it? No. And, you know, they go down the cynicism trail. So you've got to have a light touch on kind of the blood on Trump's hand stuff that is emotionally very satisfying to Trump opponents to talk about. But it gets you absolutely nothing with these voters who, frankly, think Trump is so toxic, they don't want to see toxic shot back at him because they think toxic is the bigger problem. But they do see Biden.
Say that
much
again.
More.
So what do you mean by that? That they just they don't
well,
like the
if
the
Trump
vitriol.
Says Biden's an old jerk, they don't like it. And when Biden says you're a COVID murderer, they don't like that either. They want Biden not to be like Trump. And they want a president. And I think Biden's own political instincts go there too. So that's been interesting. The other thing that's kind of funny in the numbers that there's concern about in Trump land and Bloomberg, excuse me, in Biden land, Bloomberg land, RVAT land, every land that's very focused on Florida, is Trump is overperforming with Hispanic voters compared to Hillary. Now, if you go around the state, it's not so bad in the Tampa Bay area. It's not so bad. Actually, Biden's doing quite well in Orlando, which is kind of more Puerto Rican and more Democratic. But in Miami-Dade and Broward County, Biden's overperforming. And I noticed a note from the campaign today.
Trump's overperforming.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Trump's a long day up all night doing Hanks on tap. Biden is underperforming. And he's got a Latino problem with Cubans who tend to be more Republican, old Cubans who like Trump's rhetoric and don't like, you know, they link it to the Cuban opening in the Obama-Biden administration. They don't love Kamala either. There's some racial tension there. So there, and then you've got the whole Venezuelan issue. Biden has not been that strong on Maduro. So there are local tribal Hispanic issues down there that are propping up Trump and are hurting Biden. But I just saw in a public announcement from the campaign that Biden's heading down there, and I hope he has a nice fiery speech about Venezuela. So there's a lot of attention being paid to this, but that is the one place where Trump is kind of overperforming. It's why I was surprised he didn't appoint Judge LaGoya to make a Miami play and set up the hearings as nice Miami girl versus Kamala Harris. So Comey Barrett's an impressive candidate, and in national politics probably is fine from the Republican point of view, but the Miami thing is kind of the hole in Florida right now. Everything else is going pretty good. He, you know, in our polling and in other polls, Biden is over 50% with college-educated white people. No Republican ever, no Democrat ever gets into that space. So I would say right now, zeroing out any impact of the debate, because we really don't know yet. I know what my gut is, but based on what I know before the debate, Biden was about 3 points ahead.
And In Florida.
Yeah.
And that would obviously...
Good shape, but we got some shape, more campaign coming. Yeah.
We do have a lot of... What do we have? 5 weeks? And then, of course...
Well, again, election day 2 weeks long. Call it 24 days here.
Yeah. But then, of course, some votes will trickle in after the third, and Trump will say it's illegitimate.
But not in Florida. Remember, in Florida, we have 95% counted, same in Ohio.
On the same day, yeah. But they count... Yeah. People don't understand that. It's worth explaining that for a minute, that... They sort of some states don't count vote by mail ballots till
right. Some states have a law where you basically stack them all up in a warehouse, and on election day somebody blows an air horn, and the clerks start opening a million absentee ballots and spread them out. You know, get out the and start counting
them. Or after election day.
Or the next day, yeah. Some of these clerks are unionized.
They run the election. They count the election day vote, and then they count. This worked when a vote by mail or absentee was 3%, you know, and it didn't change many races. But, so.
Most places are day of, some are after. And by the way, day of doesn't mean they get through a million of them.
Yeah.
You know, you got old Granny McGurk, the clerk with the cataracts, trying, you know, believe me. Now, increasingly, if you notice, when you do an absentee ballot, you fill out the computer card. So now we have like 1988 punch card technology there. So, again, it's not the cutting edge. But it's a pretty, what's the word for it? Resilient system. It's just slow. However, states like Florida, you mail an absentee ballot. Let's say you and I are clerks there, and this is the 16th of October. We get an AB vote by mail ballot. We count it probably within 24 hours. So there's a running count. And it's a much smarter way to do it because you spread out the work, and that way it can move quickly and yada, yada, yada. So when Florida reports, with the exception of military ballots that are coming in the mail from, you know, across the world, and there's some stuff like that, but the great majority of them, and some will have mechanical trouble, and, you know, Otis will lose a box of them in you know, Collier County somewhere. There's always a little bit of systemic error, but it's quite small. By lunchtime on Wednesday, we're going to know a hell of a lot, 95% of what happened in Florida, unless there are like epic voting machine fails and stuff like that. But the odds are good. And same in Ohio, which counts in real time. And if Biden wins either state, he's broken Trump's political neck. And if he wins both of them, which is what I think would happen tomorrow, then Trump is bare. It's over. I don't, you know, we can wait 7 years for Pennsylvania. It doesn't matter anymore. So yeah, that's why,
I mean, it is why,
that's
people,
why Biden is on a train in Ohio right now.
It's why people should think back to 2016, and you and I were both on different sets watching this. I think we may have discussed this last time briefly, but Florida, at polls close at 7:30 p.m. Different counties and precincts and all, you know, post at different times, but basically they dump a massive number of vote by mail, absentee ballots, and early voting in person ballots too, right away. And so you see these massive numbers by like 8:30. So it may be noon the next day, but it can also be 9 o'clock that night if it's a 2 or 3.
Oh, no. I say noon to get the last 8% in.
We
will probably know the night of, because, you know, half of them will be in with lightning speed. And in fact, a little tip, if you're playing the vote at home game, keep an eye on Duval County. That's Jacksonville. Romney won it. Trump won it by less, but close. It's a swing county that tilts R. Keep an eye on Trump's numbers there versus last time. And Duvall reports really quick. So it can often be the first coal mine canary in the coal mine where you can see. And that's a good early indicator.
And Florida, I think, closes pretty early, right? 7:30 p.m.
Yeah,
maybe
except
Eastern.
For the panhandle, which ties up the networks.
Right, because they don't report.
But the panhandle's 6%, 7% of the vote, so it's not that important. And you can model it as 2-to-1 R.
Well, apart from who I want to win, it would be nice to have a decisive margin, honestly, so we don't have insanity on election night and for the next weeks and conceivably months. But that's a whole other conversation which we can have in real time on November 15th when there are mobs on the street and both sides and state legislatures are sending different slates of electors from governors and we're totally in banana republic territory. But I think we should hope for this country's sake that that doesn't happen, right?
My father, the feisty 86-year-old Democrat, is suggesting that the Pentagon, if Trump is making trouble, we surround the Pentagon with a handpicked regiment of Army and Marine troops who are either African American or Latino. Just to add poetic justice to the bayonet march out. I said, a little too much, Joe, a little too far, but yeah, I appreciate the feisty Irish instincts there.
I mean, you do wonder. I mean, yeah. I 5 weeks of Trump behaving like he did last night, though, with just total lack of restraint in terms of any norms or, normal kind of campaign debate and just attacking everyone and everything and personal attack. I mean, it could be pretty crazy. I mean, it might go pretty, we've discussed it as if it's a normal race mostly, and it mostly is, I suppose. And, it's +7 Biden and things are unlikely to change for this reason, but they could change for that. But it could, of course, be total. We haven't really gone through something like this, I suppose.
Well, here's the scenario:
a guy like Trump,
that,
an incumbent who's cornered and
feels crazy
and can't afford to lose. This is not George H.W. Bush being down 9 or 10 points at the beginning of October and clawing his way back to 5.5 or whatever we were down, 7 or 8, or Carter. It's a different world, right?
I'll give you my Alan Drury novelist scenario.
I love Alan Drury.
I know you and I do. People are going to have to Google it, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He was a very good political novelist from the 50s, and yeah.
So here's my, and excuse the profanity, but I can't resist in this for our family-friendly audience. So I'm not so worried about Trump like barricading himself in the White House on Inauguration Day. But I am worried about that period where he's raving lunatic president when he's a lame duck. So in the novel, and I think this could actually happen, the cabinet sits around and says, we got to live after this. We're gone and we got to get back and we carry this huge Trump stain. And then a couple of unfriendly lawyers from Democrat land drop by and say, we're going to investigate the hell out of all you sons of bitches. We're going to tear open your lives with a can opener just on general principles. You ever thought about the 25th Amendment right now? And there is a scenario where they roll up on a carpet a week after the election, if he's going crazy, do a cabinet vote because they're all lame ducks trying to get a life again. And they can be effectively motivated about future legal survival, depending on how vengeful the Democrats are. I would say for the good of the country, don't be vengeful. And I wouldn't be surprised if Trump really acts out of line that there's a cabinet meeting and he's really not president anymore and he's going to be escorted from the building and Pence can try to rehabilitate himself by landing the plane in a classic way.
And
so that's my scenario for the system to finally, for the Republicans to find their courage far too late, but still at a useful time.
After the election, but maybe still useful. That would be something. Yeah. Well, that's a good thing to end on an Alan Drury.
We should write it for the Bulwark. Our salute to Alan Drury's scenario.
We should, absolutely. I haven't heard his name in a while, but glad to hear him mentioned. Yeah. Mike, thank you for joining
me. It's always
on this
good to
very
do this.
Busy day, the day after the debate, when you've been much in demand. So thanks for joining me. We'll do this after the election and figure out what really happened as opposed to what we think might happen. So thanks for joining me, Mike, and thank you for joining us on Conversations.